Aloha, disposable heroes. Thanks for joining us on the Big Double Digits, episode 10. We've got extra special guest, Chris from OAR. Here's what's going to go down. They form the band in Columbus, Ohio, create their own scene, making the music industry come to them. Chris goes back to school and ultimately proves you don't know something totally until you can teach it to someone else. Enjoy. All right. We're here on episode number 10. We've reached double digits, people, of Disposable Heroes. And here to mark the most triumphant of double digits is my boy, Chris Koulos, most famously from OAR. All right.
Thank you. It's good to be here. Double digits. And just hanging out with you is always a good time. What's up?
I know. Nothing much, man. I think, which is super rad, because I think every time... well, at least the last time we hung out, we fully geeked out on drums because you took me to Forks drum shop for my first time ever.
We did. When you were on tour, you guys were in Nashville and we went and I mean, that place is something you can go into weekly and it's just an awesome thing. It's one for anyone who doesn't know about Forks Drum Closet. It's kind of like an old school mom and pop drum shop that still exists today because Music City here, but it's such a working drummer's town. You know, they have all the amazing drum sets and snare drums and amazing stuff, but it's really, you know, daily for guys to go in and get the gear that they need, the, you know, screws and sticks and heads and, you know, gaff tape and this kind of stuff. Like, that's what it's all about. So you can pop in there literally any of the day of the week and see a drummer from one of the top, you know, A-list country touring bands to a session drummer to guys that are out there working the honky tonks on Lower Broadway to students that are, you know, taking classes at Belmont to up and coming kids that just, you know, just are starting to play the drums and maybe they're in there eyeing, you know, their dream set or taking lessons. So, yeah, it was fun to get to kind of take you in there and show you around for the first time.
That's so rad because you just hit it on the nose. That's exactly what you were doing because I think I even maybe like did a double take because I turned around and you were at the cash register getting your tape, stick, whatever it was, you know what I mean, and doing that exact same thing. And it reminded me of another one. Didn't they have Surf Wax there for some reason?
In the display case.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Did they had like, say, I've just, I don't know if I might be, I've dreamt this or I'm going crazy, which both might be totally correct, but I think they had sex wax, the surf, the wax in the, and what did he, I asked him about it, didn't I? Do you remember what he said?
I don't. It totally rings a bell. I don't. I mean, yeah. I'll go in there tomorrow and find out.
Let you know. Like you said, the weekly trip. That's why to Forks Drum Closet. No, but anyway, we're gonna find out to all the listeners out there. We're gonna find out at some point on Disposable Heroes the tie between sex wax / surf wax and drumming. Because obviously, if a legendary drum shop like that has it, it's got to have some major purpose in the drum world.
There's some secret use that we don't know about. You know what? I think that's when they say like there's like magic happens in the studio.
Yeah, exactly.
I think we just uncovered what's been going on with all those records since, you know, Elvis Presley.
Exactly. Boom. but no, you're so right. Back to the drum shop. That place was so it did nothing short of blow my mind, man. What a rad little tour stop and thank you again for that. But that snare room in there, all those snares they had, like, oh man, it was just like a pleasure to be in and soak up all the good snare vibes in there.
Yeah. And when you're back in town, of course, we'll obviously go, but it'll be fun because they've renovated their entire back of the shop that used to be kind of like the warehouse.
Yeah.
They've now totally redone it and opened it up. So pretty much, if not doubled, maybe tripled, I don't know what it is, but they have so much more space now, a ton more drum set. I mean, it's really just, it's insane.
Wow. Well, yeah, Abe, seriously, everyone out there, especially if you're actually a drummer yourself, Forks Drum Closet in Nashville, Tennessee. Amazing. Go check it out. But, well, let's get back to, I don't know. I actually want to, first thing I want to tell you, which I realized today was, man, you guys took us on our first like big tour that I think our band has ever been on. I just realized today in 2005, I think it was, when, you guys, OAR, took us, Pepper, on tour with us. And that was like the first time we ever played amphitheaters or anything.
That's awesome. I mean, it does not feel like it was 2005. That is crazy.
Sorry, right? It totally dated us.
Yeah.
Yeah, but no, yeah, 2005 was, and we first got, I think, from us, we were still in a van and whatnot, because that was our first tour that we got a bus ever. We had that smaller bus. I don't know if you remember. And yeah, you guys were the first ones that we ever did any of those sheds.
That was an awesome summer. Yeah. I remember it. And I, you know, I don't want to toot my own horn here, but I remember hearing, it might have been my wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, played me Ashes.
No way.
And it was, for me, one of those songs that you just cannot stop playing. You cannot, for me, it was a song I couldn't wear it out. Like, I tried. I just played it over and over and over. Each part of the song was like, oh, I can't wait till the next part. I can't wait. Oh, the next.
Nice.
And I remember just hearing that and getting in touch with our guys immediately. And I think that's one of my favorite things, you know, aside, you know, from just being in the band and being a fan of music, is being able to find bands and hook up with them. You know, there, I don't think there's enough camaraderie out there on the road. Sometimes we end up meeting some great friends, but I don't think that that's like always the biggest priority. And I think that when we find bands like you guys and a ton of other bands that we play with, you know, over and over throughout the years, it just makes what we're doing out there so much more fun and enjoyable. And then that comes across on stage. And that's what the audience wants to feel and see, because that's what they're thinking is happening.
Yeah, totally.
You know,
I couldn't agree more. I mean, you guys did it so well on that tour. I saw the video of you guys in Train this summer. Doing the Paul Simon track, right?
Yeah, that was pretty cool. They
talk about camaraderie. That was so rad to watch all summer. I was tuning in and wanting every part of that song. Couldn't wait for it, for seeing Mark up there and whatnot. It was great. Saw a couple of your videos.
It was cool what they did. I think that was Train's biggest tour as far as production they've ever been on. Had a lot of video elements, and so Pat from Train invited Mark out a little bit early, and they videotaped them kind of recreating that video of You Can Call Me Al from, like, it must have been the 80s when Chevy Chase,
yep,
and, you know, and they were kind of, he was in like the white blazer.
Yep.
And so they got that video, and that's playing in the background while Mark comes out on stage wearing the white blazer. And it built into a thing where we had our horn section on stage every night, and then it built into a thing where they had Mark and Pat doing like a Congo drum battle back and forth every night. And it was just really fun to kind of watch that, like a band like at that level, just to have that much fun on stage and still, you know, to be as dialed in, you know, to like what they're doing as far as putting on like a headlining amphitheater tour.
Right.
But to be able to, like, you know, be able to, you know, have fun, bring us up on stage and give us a little nod. How cool is that, man? We had a blast. They're just all those guys. You know, Pat kind of seems to be like the face of the band, but everyone in the band are band members. They're not hired guns. And these guys, not only incredible musicians, but they were just super cool guys that, you know, in different ways took us under their wing. You know, I'd hang out, chat it up with the drummer, learn a lot, watch him every night. You know, all these guys are around, you know, during dinner, we'd sit there and talk about music, you know, Jerry, the guitar player, the keys and everything like that. We would just kind of nerd out over stuff, and just, it was just cool to see what they're doing at that level.
No kidding. It almost sounds like to me that they're at the highest level almost you could get, or pretty much that you can get, and there's still a huge human element in it. Like you said, you know what I mean? They're actually real people, real band. It's not like this like manufactured kind of thing. Is what I'm kind of, I think I'm getting from what you're saying.
Yeah, you nailed it.
That's so rad. I love to hear that. I love to hear when those kind of things exist at such high levels of any industry and whatnot. It's so awesome. Did you guys have the train connection from Matt Wallace, our mutual friend, the man, the myth, the legend?
Matt Wallace. I can't believe you're bringing up Matt Wallace. This is my day. Just got a lot better.
Yeah, Matt. We love that guy, man. We had so much fun on our self-titled album with him.
I'm not sure where the connection came from. I know Matt worked with Train. I know we've worked with Matt a bunch. Mm-hmm. I know there's a lot, you know how small the business gets, and a lot of people know each other. I want to say Mark met Pat through Greg Wattenberg. Have you guys written or done anything with him? He's, you know, producer, writer.
No.
He's based in New York.
Okay.
I think Mark started writing with him probably around the time we all met, if not within a year or two after that, because they wrote Shattered together,
okay,
which for us is our biggest kind of radio and or mainstream song.
Didn't Wallace produce that?
He did.
Nice.
Yeah.
Full circle. I'll,
yeah, we can totally get into that. But yeah. I think the Train thing was more Mark may have met Pat that way.
Gotcha.
And seen each other writing in the studio because Greg Wattenberg was working with Pat and was also working with Mark. And I think they met as, you know, kind of in, you know, who's coming and going from the studio and you see each other every day.
Right.
And kind of chatted it up. And, you know, throughout the next couple of years, whether we kind of cross paths on like, you know, those holiday jingle ball jams they have, like radio stations have around the holidays.
Uh-huh. Of course.
We'd see them a lot because they're a band that, again, I think, you know, to have had this much success they've had for like 20 years, consistently having songs on the radio at a high level really shows you what big radio can kind of do. And they played, I want to say we did like 45 dates this summer, and they were all pretty much sheds. Like, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
You know, and like, you know, again, like I'm kind of getting sidetracked here, but
no, that's what it's all about. That's what that's what Disposable Heroes is all about. You know what I mean? The conversation and getting all around there. So go for it, brother.
Yeah. So I'm guess it, just to kind of wrap it up, like, you know, we crossed paths with them there. And I think recently we've had similar, our booking agency, I think may have, you know, kind of connected the dots a little bit there. Uh-huh. So that kind of led up to us, you know, being able to open up for them for this past summer.
Nice.
And, we had a great time.
That's so awesome. So that talking about this last summer, we were just talking about with Train. Let's go back to when we toured with you in 2005. And I guess I just wanted to comment on from my perspective, I think you guys really just showed us how the DIY thing and how to like that, I guess the possibilities, you know, us as a band at that point where we were like, okay, I think this is going to happen, a career, this and that. And then seeing you guys and then the realization of, wow, they've done this all by themselves. And that was such a huge inspiration to us. And thank you guys for that. And it was so rad. And I want you to, if you don't mind talking a little bit about that and how you guys brought up the band on that kind of work ethic and mindset.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I'm just trying to think where to start. It's almost kind of like from the very, very beginning, we kind of had a little bit of a grassroots approach that, I don't know, without, and it was also, I'm kind of also thinking back that like, it was such a different industry back then. I mean, we were still, like, there was still MTV, there was still CDs, there were still Tower Records, there were still all, it was a totally different world.
The 90s, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And similar to you guys, I think we started, well, I mean, we started in 1996 officially, but a couple of us had been playing in bands for 3 or 4 years before that. Like basically we started our first band in eighth grade after seeing Pearl Jam on MTV Unplugged.
Oh, legendary.
It was, I mean, that without a doubt changed our life. And that just inspired us to start a band immediately. our singer, Mark, and I, just kids growing up down the street from each other. I mean, our parents knew each other before, you know, we were even born. So we grew up, you know, we were in every elementary school through college. We went to every summer camp together. We played every sport as kids. We, you know, got into music together. We got, you know, that whole kind of a thing. And so when we saw Pearl Jam and Unplugged, we wanted to start a band. And I could kind of play drums because my dad was a drummer, a great drummer actually, and had a drum set in the basement. And Mark had been singing and acting in plays, in local theater, stuff like that. So he could kind of sing. So we just needed a guitar player and a bass player, and we kind of put together our first band in eighth grade, and we found our guitar player, Richard Ahn, and we played the eighth grade talent show.
So sick.
It was crazy. I still say that it was the loudest crowd that we've ever had to date.
What'd you guys play?
We played Eric Clapton, Wonderful Tonight, but not the slow ballad that it is. We played kind of like a almost like a reggae influenced version of it. It was a little rocky reggae up-tempo version of it, and then we played Porch by Pearl Jam. Sick. And that was without a doubt my favorite thing ever, and it was just crazy. We were on stage with the curtains closed, and as they opened up, it was like life-changing. It was just, without even knowing how to put my finger on it, it was just like something clicked, and I was like, this is what I want to do with my life. It was cool.
That's so.
It was cool, and
it's just like, talk about human element. You know what I mean? Like you guys starting from there, and then did you guys have a name for what the band was at that point?
Yeah, I'm embarrassed to say. No, I'm not embarrassed. I'm proud of it. It was funny. It was we were called Exposed Youth.
Nice. Okay.
And we were in eighth grade. We thought it fit in perfectly with like all the grunge bands that we were, you know, were our favorite brands. And then we realized like Exposed Youth, as we were getting a little bit older, is like not exactly appropriate.
Right. Right.
So yeah. Anyway, Exposed Youth itself didn't survive. I wouldn't say we didn't survive. It just, you know, Richard played the show and then was like, I didn't like the bass player. I quit. And we were like, okay, well, you know, we don't think he fit. It was fine, but we don't think he fit. We've already fired him. You cannot quit. So I don't know what the deal was at the time, but he was out of there. So I think for the next like 2 or 3 years, Mark and I just kind of messed around in bands together with a couple other musicians, mostly all cover bands. But right before, I think, Richard quit, he had started teaching Mark to play guitar. So Mark started playing a little bit, soon started writing his own songs. We got to a point, fast forward like 2 years later, now we're in high school, and Mark started writing his first songs that would become the first OAR songs. And we played, him and I played like a buddy's 16th birthday party, and we were just playing around. We were like, all right, Richard, without a doubt, is still our favorite guitar player we've ever played with. And we were still friends with him, but we hadn't played in a band with him since eighth grade. So we convinced him to come over to check out what we were up to. And meanwhile, I had been working over the summer as a lifeguard and found out Benj Gershman was a bass player. So he was like, you know, another lifeguard with me. And so we invited him over. He wanted to come over and jam. So we invited him over the day that Richard was coming over, and the four of us just clicked. And we just started in the basement. And I giving you this whole long backstory to let you know that where this history kind of came from, as just kind of being friends before we were in a band. And that spirit started to kind of take on a life of its own. And the style of music was more about like us finding the type of music we were excited to be playing after, you know, a few years of just playing, you know, covers and playing in other bands. This was something was brewing, you know?
Right.
And we started playing we call it a local bar. I think that's what we said. But looking back, it was really just like a pizza place. It just sounded cooler to say that we were at a bar.
Of course. You know? Of course.
So we would play. This is now our like junior year and senior year of high school. And we would play like, let's say once a month on like a Thursday night at the pizza place / awesome rock bar. And just all of our friends started coming out, and even parents started coming, and just it started spreading a little bit. I'm not sure exactly how to put, you know, like our finger on. We just knew something was happening.
Right.
And so as we were getting ready to graduate, and Benj was a year behind us, but we were just like trying to figure out, like, if we all go different ways, like there's just no way we're going to be able to make this, you know, give this a real shot. And so we thought, well, if we all go to college together and pick a place where we can all get into and go to a place that gives us kind of like a platform to really try to take off, like we owe it to ourselves to give it a real shot. So we picked Ohio State. At the time, it was the biggest school in the country. There's like 60,000 students, close to like 100 bars, you know, around campus. There's like the downtown area. There's all this stuff going on. And there was a music scene. I mean, it wasn't New York or Seattle or LA or anything like that, but it was definitely had a music scene.
What is it? The Newport Music Hall, is it?
Yes.
Yeah.
So we didn't get in. And I'd love to tell you a story about this in a second.
Let's do it.
We thought we were totally going to get into that, you know, touring scene in Columbus, and it didn't quite work out that way because we just showed up from out of town without like a manager or any kind of touring history, and none of the promoters would book us. And it took us kind of some roundabout ways, which I think kind of gets to your idea about this grassroots thing about being able to do it on your own. And when we got to Columbus and we weren't able to book shows, we had to figure out how to do it on our own. And we just basically called up the Newport, and on like a Tuesday night when there wasn't a band playing, we rented it out ourselves and sold tickets for $5 around campus. And I did jump ahead a little here. You can't just rent out a place like the Newport and sell tickets for $5 if you're only going to sell a couple tickets, because you just wouldn't be able to afford to rent it.
Right.
What happened was there was a combination of Napster taking off right as we were getting to Columbus, and the music started spreading around a little bit that way. And then also us playing a bunch of just campus parties. We would just set up shop, or we would play at a fraternity house, or we would play at a house party, or we would play. There was like a church and synagogue things and club, you know, school clubs, just things. We would just literally started playing anything and everything we could.
Right.
And there started building a buzz. And none of the promoters knew that that was going on. This was still so early. They didn't know what Napster was. They didn't know we had a following. So we said, screw that, man. We've got enough of a following now from these like house parties and stuff like that, just putting flyers up all around town, passing CDs out. We had a sales rep program where we printed up like 1,000 CDs at a time. We'd give like a box of CDs to a bunch of sales reps that, you know, were pretty much just our friends. And we told them, hey, do your best to sell them, but if you got to give them out, give them away, man. Just throw on the CD at a party. Or if you meet somebody who's in your class who works at the, you know, radio college radio station, give them a CD. Like things like that started happening. So it started spreading, and we basically rented out the Newport. And like I said, they had no idea what to expect. They had like one security guy at the door and like one bartender, or like two bartenders for the Newport, which, you know, is like,
yeah, it's like 1500 people it holds, or like,
yeah,
like it's a legit venue. It's kind of almost as legit as the Awesome Rock Bar, AKA Pizza Place.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it might not have as much rock and roll history as the Pizza Place,
yeah,
exactly. But it's close.
Yeah. For sure, though. Yeah, it's a legit place.
We did that enough times until the promoters took notice. And that was, you know, for us a way of saying, like, if we can't get our foot in the door, you just kind of create our own way. And I don't know how to say it other than that. I don't know, looking back, how we would have known to kind of do that. But it also kind of gave us the upper hand. Now that they knew that we were, you know, had a presence, then we'd be able to say, oh, okay, well, now that we can book shows the traditional way, we want the show on a Friday night, or we don't want it on a Friday night. In Columbus, Thursday night is a better night. So like those kinds of things, we started taking a grassroots approach to booking our own shows, to building an audience. And then once we had those shows, we started having tapers, like come out and tape the shows. I don't know if that's anything people still do.
Oh, yeah, yeah, like kind of.
That was huge.
That kind of, I mean, in the for lack of a better term, in like the jam band world, I mean, even like Jack Johnson, I remember when he first started coming out in like 2000 or 2001, there'd be the live CDs all over the place being traded, this and that. I mean, that's kind of what you're talking about with the tapers, right?
Exactly. And they had this whole community of trading tapes. And you'd say, like, hey, I was at Jack Johnson. I've got this. I want Dave Matthews Band. And someone would say, all right, well, I'll send you Sublime for this. And they had these very, very early internet message boards. And through that, they just had a community of friends. Oh, you're going to the show? I need a ticket. Oh, I need a ride. I need this. Oh, who's this band? I'll trade you this. I'll give you a bunch of these live shows. And so what ended up happening is we saw that taking off, and we saw what was successful about that is because our shows were different from night to night. Like, we didn't play the same set list.
Right.
And even if we played the same song, we did different versions of the songs.
Right.
Not so different that they weren't recognizable, but, like, you know, we would stretch them out and
Yeah.
jam. And we weren't a jam band the way, you know, we're talking about the jam band community,
Right.
but we did improvise a lot, and our singer would, you know, freestyle a lot of lyrics. Things like that made each night a unique night. And for tape traders, that was awesome because it wasn't, you know, like hearing the same, you know, hour long set where the, you know, they play the same song in the same order with the same, you know, friendly chat in between songs and just switch up the city that they're in.
Right.
Hello, Cleveland. You know,
Yeah.
hello. So, like,
You're almost hoping for a
that.
mistake at that point because you're like, something different. All right. He dropped a stick.
Yeah, exactly. So, with that tape trading community, with Napster, with all that stuff kind of going
You
on,
think
we
they
were
work
able
hand
to
in
kind of.
hand? The tape trading, sorry to cut you off, but the tape trading community and Napster, you think that kind of worked hand in hand with each other and didn't work against each other?
I think so. I think for us, it absolutely did. And it's hard to say because it, man, it would have been nice to be one of those bands that had an awesome major label at the time that was blasting your music through MTV and on all the radio and in movies and soundtracks. And you know what I mean? Like how bands broke in those days. Like some of my favorite bands are from that era.
Right.
And I don't think we ever had that level of mainstream success. What we were able to build, I'm so looking back, I'm so much more happy that we have what we have because whether it's our own little like niche market, our own bubble, our own audience, our own people who've been coming to see us for 20 years, we're going to do what we can to try to get more people out to see us. But I think we're always paying attention to who our core audience is and keeping that in mind, you know, and you still got to change things up and grow and kind of move in a direction that you want to go as a business, as an artist, as you know, a writer, all that kind of stuff. But it really kind of came from, like you said, like just this community spirit of Napster and the tape trading community that all shared stuff with each other.
Yeah, I mean, and at the end of the day, you guys have created your own ecosystem, a vertical of your own. You know what I mean? It's so rad, and I don't know. I think it's just such a more solid foundation. People always ask about our band and how we've done it, and I think that way of doing it, the slow build, it always at the end of the day results to such a solid foundation, in my opinion.
It does. It does. And like similar to you guys that you've started your own label, you guys are in control of, you know, whether it's merch, whatever it is you guys have done along the way, been able to pick your own producers or go in and do that kind of stuff. When you when you're in charge and have to make the decisions, not that you shouldn't have a great team around you. You should have, you know, at some level, you know, your manager, your lawyer, your agent, a business manager, hopefully a label. You have your awesome team, but when you're involved in the decision-making process, then you learn about all these different areas and you learn about publishing and how that relates to what you're doing on the merchandise side of things and you relate to how that's doing on the distribution side of things and how that's related to just all the aspects of this stuff. And that's something that can't happen if you just have a song that breaks on the radio, and then all of a sudden you're a massive star. You know, like I don't want to hate on that because that's amazing. That's great. You may not have the skills to go out and put on a show because you haven't been doing that for, you know, years and years and years. But like you can get to a point of building your artistry up, you know, kind of on stage. But I think it's really hard to go back and learn what it takes to take something from small and slowly build it to where the, you know, kind of like the stock market over time, it's continuing to grow.
Right. Right. No matter where, if you look at the big picture of everything, you can see the growth in something like that, or even like you're saying, I mean, you guys 21 years, right? You said 96 you guys started, because we just,
yeah.
Yeah. So man, that's so awesome. Congratulations. You and the boys rule, man. I love you guys.
Oh, man.
Real quick though, then going back, let's talk about, getting outside of the band a little bit. Let's talk about what really was the main, spark that lit your fire to play drums. Obviously your dad was a drummer. It was that kind of the main, driving force when you were young to pick up drumsticks.
Totally. I saw my dad play drums in the basement and just like a kid, you know, in awe of your dad, just like, oh my God. He taught me a couple things to get started, you know, a couple beats. But honestly, when I look back on it, it was kind of more like, and he didn't pressure me to like take lessons or practice or do anything. I think he just wanted me to kind of have fun with it. And I was also interested at a young age where I probably wouldn't have been able to handle regular lessons or anything like that. But for me, it was a thing that like you did as a kid in between going outside to skateboard and then going and playing basketball and then going inside to play Nintendo. And then you go downstairs and you play the drums and then you go back outside and you meet the friends and you play football. And it was just one of my like hobbies. Like it just, I didn't practice the drums as much as I played for fun. And I think as I started getting in the band later on, you know, with Mark in eighth grade, it was because of just our love of music. Like, I just wanted to discover new music, and I loved like turning my friends on to new music, like being the one in the car going like, "Hey, check this out."
Yeah.
Be like, "Oh, this is awesome." You know, I don't, for me, I can't imagine why everyone isn't like that. And I don't think some people are. I think people are just as passionate to like hear new music. They want to be turned on to new music, you know, from somebody else. And that's amazing too. So like later on in high school, I was actually like a DJ. I was hired as like the youngest ever DJ at Bristol Sounds. And I would go and I'd play all these like proms and, you know, just events around town and stuff like that. But it was just like wanting to be around new music and play music and all of that kind of stuff. You know, I don't know. I think I like being in a band, and I liked, I don't want to say promoting a band because I didn't think of that at the time, but that's what we were doing more than going downstairs and shedding my craft and all this kind of stuff. And I actually had in junior high and all that stuff, like I was in, you know, symphonic band and I did marching band and a lot of stuff like that. But for some reason, I just didn't see the connection between like learning and practicing and developing that side of my drumming and musicianship, you know, with kind of being in a rock band after school. They were like separate things for me at the time, which I really wish I had found a way to connect the dots, because there were some other drummers in marching band with me that were playing at such a high level and were so willing to help me out. And there were teachers that I was going to, you know, just to kind of get through whatever, you know, sheet music we were learning for the thing, that they could have helped me on this stuff. I didn't see it at the time. I was young and having fun. And after school, I wanted to go be with my friends and I wanted to be in a band and I didn't want to go play drums and practice rudiments, you know? And I say rudiments because that's what I thought it was. And I don't think it should have been, but I'm, you know, not to sound negative or anything like that, but I was just focused on different areas. And then, you know, we started playing in college, and, you know, then I don't have a drum set really, you know, you live in the dorms, you live wherever. And so it sort of started to get away from me. And not until way after college, probably right around the time I met you, did I really start to like pump the brakes and say, I need to start practicing. I need to figure this out. I feel out of control and I'm not happy about it. I just got really, really frustrated with my playing. And at that point, it really, you know, started a whole new chapter of kind of practicing and falling in love with the drums and not just music, you know?
Right. That was, so like you're saying, that was right around the time that you met me, right? Or that we went on tour with you?
It had to have been. I
Because,
mean, maybe not that summer, but it was that.
well, because I remember another mutual friend of ours, Aaron Pincus, the agent, telling me that you were like all about taking lessons and you were doing like just fully like delving into like the creative or like I don't know what you want to call it, like the theory side of it. And I remember being so like wow, like are you kidding me? Like that's so rad. Like the successful drummer in my eyes is like just delving back into like school in a sense, you know? So, like that's kind of what you're talking about, right? That time of as far as the timeline goes of your career, right?
Yeah, it aligns where there was sort of like when the band was getting to be the biggest it's ever been, is the time where really my frustration started really kind of showing up because I kind of felt like the band was getting bigger than the level of, drumming I could play at.
That's so interesting. And you know
It's
that
weird to
that
say.
you know that probably was a obviously just a personal thing, right? 'Cause I mean, at the end of the day, I don't know, levels of bands and popularity of bands and musicians and the level of their craft never really align, right? So that's rad of you to challenge yourself and 'cause all that is just challenging yourself and wanting to make yourself a better artist or whatever it is that your craft is, you know?
Yeah, it totally is. And I'm so glad. And in a lot of ways, I wish that happened more often in ways where you just kind of have like maybe the rug pulled out from underneath you or somebody rip you a new asshole. Like that kind of stuff, as much as like you hate going through it, it's the worst thing at the time. Like it can really be a life-changing, experience. And for me, I couldn't do what I wanted to do. I always thought, like, just say for example, my left hand. I always thought my left hand would get better, and it just never did. Or things that I like, we were playing all the time, and that was the era where we could play 250 shows a year. So I'm playing every night, and I hear things in my head that I'm either not able to play them, or I physically don't know how to. Like I know the song so well, I know what I want to do, but I can't make my hands and legs and feet and do all this stuff together. And I would just walk off stage like furious about it. And I just figured I had to do something about it and start somewhere. And so, and it was great. I started, chatting it up with drummers while we'd be out on the road and touring. I'd get little tips and stuff like that, which started helping. But I really thought that I needed to kind of like, I don't know, get help from a teacher, like a solid teacher. And I didn't know how to do that because we were on the road all the
Yeah,
time.
find time alone. That's what
Exactly.
that's that was it seems like would have been a major hurdle.
Yeah. So, and again, like going back to my dad, he d hadn't still played drums. He didn't even really play drums at the time, like for professionally, when he, by the time he showed me, he had, he was still working in the music business. He's actually the a manager of a pro sound department at Chuck Levin's. I don't know if you've been into Chuck Levin's when you're ever in the DC area, but that's, if we're talking about legendary music stores besides Forks, that's, that would be on the top of the list,
Nice. You'll have to take me there. You'll have to take me there.
I'll take you there and you take me to Pro Drum when I'm out your way.
Let's do it.
So anyway, I called the guy who ran the drum counter at Chuck's and told him my problem. I just said, I don't know how to do this. I'm on the road, but I need to find a teacher. I'll do whatever I can do. And he said, hey, I've got the right guy for you. He put me in touch with him, and the guy was absolutely amazing. Immediately, had me come over, and we just started working on the basics. The stuff that I probably should have been paying attention to when I was younger, and I just didn't, whether it was reading and writing and rudiments and different styles of music like jazz and getting my independence and all that stuff together. It was just all about building like a foundation that I didn't have. And then that started to connect the dots. And then it became a many, 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 many years of a journey, but at least I felt like I was headed in the right direction now, and I was on the right path. And so that started to make me feel like I was at least in control. So like then I could feel like, hey, I can have fun while I'm playing, even though I'm still not at the point where I can like play what I want to play that's in my head, but like at least I'm on the right path. And so yeah, that started a lot of stuff. And since then I've been working with a lot of teachers. A few years ago, I would say, this was, let's just say, 2005 or 2006. I started working with that teacher in DC, and then probably around 2010, I started taking some online classes. Berkeley has online courses, which I think can be amazing. I don't know if I'd recommend them to everybody, but I think it's one of these things that's, you'll get out what you're willing to put into it.
Right. And you got to be proactive.
Amazing classes. Yeah. Right. And then just, man, just then started taking up with like some drummers as like mentors. Being in Nashville, there's some guys that have been doing this on the highest level for years and years and years. And at that point I started wanting to expand into, you know, maybe studio stuff, or how do I do different styles, or what can I do about recording? And I need, you know, gear, and I need all that kind of stuff. And then got to a point where I felt, you know, comfortable enough to start teaching. You know, they say, all right, you know, like that's really when you're going to connect the dots. Like if you think like, you know what a dotted eighth is, you know, eighth note.
Yeah.
Like try explaining that to an 11-year-old kid who's never heard of it before. And it's like, oh, I know what it is. And then you go, oh, well, wait. Okay. So, you know, so yeah.
Yeah.
So that's been my kind of thing. So the last couple of years, obviously I'm still working and practicing and shedding, but my focus has changed a little bit, and I've also really enjoyed kind of teaching and connecting the dots that way.
Yeah, totally. That, I mean, that's such a great analogy, like thinking you know something and then trying to teach it. That's like for, I mean, anything, because I've recently taken a couple of people out surfing, my girlfriend and a friend, and pushing them into waves and trying to explain to them what I know as muscle memory.
Yeah.
Is like a whole different story. So, I mean, yeah, talk about you hit the nail on the head, connecting the dots in like the most ultimate, complete way possible.
What's your drumming history?
I'm this kind of self-taught way, you know, same thing with, my dad was a musician kind of like you, except he played guitar and was the lead singer in his band from the 80s called The Law. And that's where like our record label name comes from, and everything. And he taught me a couple beats, and I kind of took it to there, and then got to a point where I could see what I was hearing in my head, yeah. You know, and just started. That's how I think I started I don't know which, for lack of a better term, like excelling, you know, and being able to play things. And then I started playing in bands with, I was in a band with my dad and when I was like 13 years old or 12 years old. And I started playing with some older musicians, because coming from a small town of Kona, there wasn't like a ton of musicians in general. So I ended up jamming with a lot of like older dudes and that wanted to just jam all the time. So yeah, it was kind of just the school of life, I guess you could say, for me. And then I'm, you know,
what was it like playing with the older guys? They give you tips? Were they like, was anybody like, in my mind, like this is like a movie, and there was like a guy who was like, yo, you need to like get on the tempo, or like your swing is like not happening or something. Was there any kind of like thing that like at the time you were like, oh shit, like I didn't realize I was doing that, like I need to get this together?
Yeah, no, it was more just the element of practicing things over and over and over and over, I think, was the main thing that I learned, or that I kind of got used to, or and instilled in my brain, I guess you could say. And that's also in turn kind of what burnt me out, because after doing that for a couple years as a little kid, I stopped playing drums for a while until we started up the band. And then since then, I kind of, like you said, and kind of part of your journey, everyone I go out on tour with, I'm always watching and trying to soak things up and whatnot. You know, that's why I asked you about that. And I know I heard about you delving back into that side of the study side of drumming. And I remember that story from years ago. And when I, you know, was kind of prepping and thinking about this podcast with you, I'd thought about it, and I don't know, man, I big you up so much for going down that side, because it's something I actually want to do at some point. So
wow, that's cool of you to say, man. Well, we will nerd out anytime.
Yeah, I know. I'd say it's so fun, man. So yeah. But so speaking of I guess, nerding out a bit. What are you guys doing next? What's next on the? You guys did the big tour this summer, you guys did the 20th anniversary. You guys did a record, right, for the 20th anniversary?
We did. Yeah, it was kind of a compilation, almost like a greatest hits of 10 of our most familiar studio songs and 10 live songs. And then we also recorded a couple brand new songs for the project. We filmed it along the way, a little documentary series, just kind of trying to write a song that we felt was important to our career, as opposed to something at the time we had been like maybe chasing down radio hits, which we had some success with and some that didn't go the way we thought to, but all stuff we were proud of, but we just thought we need to take a step back and just write something that we feel is important to us and meaningful, and let that see if we can connect that way and let the audience in on that writing process and just kind of see where we're at with that. And we ended up coming up with a couple brand new songs for that project. So it was fun that it was like kind of greatest hits, kind of new songs, you know, some live, some studio, just celebrating, you know, the first 20 years of OAR.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah, the first 20 years, I love it.
Yeah. So we're at now, yeah. So we had the Train tour this summer, which was pretty much May until the end of July almost. It was a long tour. And it came at just an amazing time for us too, personally. A couple of guys in the band had babies. I just had a baby. You know, she's like 5 months old. So, you know, to kind of had
congratulations.
Spent some time
congratulations.
Thank you, brother.
Yeah, of course.
You know, we're in that in between touring spot right now. I think we're heading out in about a week or two for a fall tour, for about a month or so. And then, we're really just in the writing process right now. And it's so great because everyone's got like their home studio set up, and our singer in New York City has an amazing studio set up down in like Times Square. So we're all shooting each other ideas. You know, they take the reins on the writing stuff for sure, but we're all involved to a certain degree. And I think this is kind of a fun time around because I've been living either in a condo or something for so long. Now that I'm based here in Nashville and have a house, I can actually have a drum set and actually have a real working studio. And that gives me at least the opportunity to work on songs. And it may not be anything that, you know, makes an album or even makes it into a batch of songs we try to do for pre-pro. But at the very least, it's letting me kind of work on a different side of the music thing. And I'm getting familiar with the recording side of stuff, which, man, I've obviously such a respect for what these dudes do in the studio. And I've, you know, had, like you, I've been, you know, been able to make a bunch of records. So you're sort of familiar with what mics go on the toms or what overheads you like and that kind of stuff.
Sort of. Yeah.
I don't necessarily know the names of them, but like, I'm like, oh yeah, I like that square one. Yeah. I like that one. You know, it's like, yeah, that one costs $20,000. Yeah. Oh no, that one costs like $18. It was at Radio Shack. It just sounds cool when you plug it in through this. So it's like, there is such a crazy level of knowledge that these engineers have and what their experience. So I'm not interested in becoming an engineer or any of that stuff, but to have my hands on it in a way that I've never had before, to do it on my own. Now I'm learning at least how to communicate better with them when I go back in the studio.
Yeah. It's a language of its own.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Like, it's amazing because like total overgeneralization, but like when I'm in the studio, I'm talking to an engineer, their mindset is one way. And mine is like, it needs to sound more glassy. Or it's too orange. I want it to be blue. You know, in your head, you think that this makes sense.
Right.
But what the engineer wants to hear is like, you know, maybe something about EQ or maybe something about compression or maybe something about the mic placement or so, you know what I mean? Okay, I got to translate what this guy wants when he says he wants it to be more blue, you know, like,
right.
Okay. So now I'm starting to develop a little bit more of that. So I think the communication is the best part, you know, when we're in the studio. And that also plays into the songwriting too. When I'm here working with songwriter friends and I send stuff over to the band, you know, to, you know, have ideas flowing, you know, it just makes it more fun. And that's, again, like we were talking about with Matt Wallace at the very beginning, which we need to definitely have a whole rap about Matt Wallace before this podcast ends. But
we'll jump into that next because, yeah, God bless the Falcon, Matt Wallace. But, yeah, go on.
I'm just, just been able to kind of just focus on writing and then record this winter, and then we'll try to get some new music out and do a headlining tour 2018 promoting a brand new record.
Nice. And then, so last thing about the recording process, you talk about any ideas that you have, whether they make it to pre-production, to the album, to wherever, you love it because you have the capacity to do that now and you can send them out. Does any of the other guys in the other band maybe have a little guitar riff or vocal melody or something that they send to you that maybe are like, oh, I'm kind of looking for maybe a groove that's going to get me to that next level of inspiration to go further with this thing? Does that direction of creativity happen as well, or is it mainly you just shooting out ideas to keep the conversation going?
Well, so it used to happen really when we would get in a room together and play, and often that would just be if we're on tour, because we toured so much, we'd want to get as much accomplished while we were maybe spending an hour or so on stage for sound check. So we'd use that time to write. I think more so in the last year or so, 2 years, we spent time on the bus trying to write more, just broken down with the guitar. It doesn't need to be so fully developed. You know, the technology is amazing that our guitar player or our sax player or our singer can put together a fully developed demo. But there's also that something that's restricting about that.
100%.
Because you hear how it's locked into place only as that song, as if it's almost finished. Mm-hmm. And it's just like with any time we have a demo and we play it for an A&R guy, or I play it for my wife or a friend, and I'm like, oh, but it's not mixed yet. Or, oh, but it's not, this is the demo. We're probably going to do a different melody on the chorus. It's just like, no one cares. They hear the music and you hear what you hear, right? You know? And yes, you can go and dig in and work on different stuff when you're in a room. But when you've got a piece of music, sometimes it's great to just sit there with the guitar. If it holds up with vocals and a guitar, man, that's where it's at.
Yeah, totally. I mean, you can't really do much with a dried, finished piece of clay, you know, like the small ball that's still pliable and ready to work with is kind of like that acoustic vibe you're talking about. That's a little more free. Kind of on paper, but
and maybe for some bands that's great because they have a very specific direction sonically or stylistically or whatever. I think what works for us as a band is that we can be all over the place. We can have a song that's rock, or we can have a song that's islandy, you know, got a little bit of a reggae influence, or we can have a song that's got a little bit of a country swing or something like that. And I think when you hear it with just a guitar and a vocal, it allows us to kind of take the music where it wants to go, as opposed to like where it's already been written.
Right. Yeah, no, that's badass. So yeah, last thing and that we got to talk about, like you said before we let each other go today, is the man, the myth, the legend, Matt Wallace. Did you guys do a whole album with him, or just you guys did a whole album that Shattered was on, right?
I think we've done two albums.
Two albums. Yes,
we definitely did the album with Shattered. So that was the first time. We got together with Matt Wallace, and I want to say maybe we got together just for like a random weekend. We went in the studio just to kind of all feel each other out and see how the vibe was going. We had so much fun. We hired him for the record, and he's just the kind of guy, like, you know, I'm sure you'll have great stories about it. He's just such a fan of music, and it's just like he's got this energy. It's almost this kid-like thing when you hear something cool and you want to explore an idea, and he's like, yeah, let's try it. Or he just has great ways of what, you know, the best producers are just kind of making you feel comfortable.
Yeah.
You know, whether you know it or not, he's in charge. He's going to make some great decisions. He's not making you feel like he is, though.
Yeah.
He makes you feel like whatever you're doing as a band, let's capture that. And that's inspiring because, you know, again, like I told you, some of my frustrations, that wasn't just on stage. It was in the studio. Working with the click track the first time. Oh my God, that's a little scary. And the band's you know, at that point was big enough where we were able to work with some big name producers, right? That's awesome. But big name producers are really used to working with the best musicians in the business.
Right.
So when us, you know, get up there and start playing, we're just basement band kids, no training. They're almost looking for a certain, not level of playing, because I don't know how to say it as poetically as I mean, but there's just, whether it's a feel thing even, like, yeah. I just didn't have what you needed to do in this, like, it can be so simple. Like that first beat my dad showed me in the basement was probably, you know, kick on 1 and 3 and snare on 2 and 4. Like whatever version of, you know, kick, snare, kick, snare, kick, snare, kick, kick, snare. Like we all learned that as our first beat.
Of course.
Right? Give me any person in the world, you know, someone who says they're so uncoordinated. In less than 5 minutes, I can show them how to play that beat. And they're going to be playing a beat that you're going to hear on the radio 80 or 90% of the time. That's what those, you know, that beat is. But if it's that easy to play that beat, then why isn't anybody just being called into the studio to record with the highest level guys?
Right.
You know, for the Eric Claptons, for the, oh, I don't want to
say. It's almost like you're saying, like, not even like a skill level, but just a level of professionalism, I guess. These guys are used to working with these top level producers that you're talking about.
Professionalism, which includes, you know, that level of that, or musicality, or just feel, or just understanding of, you know, the of just cooking music from scratch.
Right.
You know, it's a total different beast than live drummers. You know, the studio thing is a, you know, a pretty interesting place. So anyway, just my point is just that we had the opportunity to work with these big producers, and they're used to working with guys at that level. And so you start to see those challenges when they're, you know, when they know how they want to work a certain way, or they're expecting a certain thing that you can't deliver on, you're trying your best to, you know? So, so to get into the studio with Wallace and have him kind of embrace us as a band and capture what I can do, but work on, I don't know, kind of like whatever my strengths were, show that. Let's find the tempo that works. Let's find the, oh, speaking of which, that was when I first met the sack.
Oh, yeah, Mike Fasano. Mm-hmm. Big up Mike Fasano. We had him on a prior episode, of course. One of the
great
by the
way.
Yeah, know thank you.
About him, and that was great to you know, hear his whole history.
Yeah, I really think, man, any good drummer, he comes into your life at one point or another, and this is yours, amazing. So he came in to do that first that record with Shattered to put the drums together for Wallace and
we
and did. Everything.
We were out at is it Sound City?
Yep. Right across from where Studio Deluxe is, Wallace's studio.
Exactly.
Yep.
Exactly. So we did like basics, like drums and bass over at Sound City.
Okay.
And then we're over at Studio Deluxe, which is matched kind of like overdub studio. And while we were there, Metallica came into Sound City. And so we just get to go outside on our breaks and just sit there. And you could hear Metallica blasting from outside of the studio. It was the coolest thing ever.
That's what record were they recording?
I don't know. It would have been 2008.
2008. Oh, like Death Magnetic or something?
Yeah. It wasn't Saint Anger.
No, Death it was Magnetic, after. It was the one. Like, I think it was Death Magnetic when they went super. Oh, that was when they switched to Rick Rubin, too. Rick Rubin did that album.
Yes. That was
from
it.
Bob Rock. They switched from Bob Rock for the first time, a few albums. So, So, oh man, that's so rad. So, I mean, I would assume your drums sounded better than they'd ever sounded when the sack tuned them and got you all dialed.
Yeah, it was just that whole experience. I think that was maybe the first full record we've ever done in California. I think we'd gone out to do overdubs or something like that on the previous album with Jerry Harrison, another amazing producer. But this was the first time where we kind of like moved out to LA for a few months and worked on an entire album out there, and to work at an amazing studio like Sound City. And, you know, Mike Fasano drives up in this, you know, white suburban or whatever it was, Tahoe or something like that. I just remember him opening up the trunk and just tons of gear. And then the next day more and more came, and it was just like this unbelievable studio with unbelievable drum sounds. And he just you know, he's just there for you. Like, you know, I was listening to his whole thing. He doesn't matter if it's Guns N' Roses or if it's, you know, OAR trying to make, you know, a small little record, you know, on our first major label or something like that.
Yeah, or Pepper trying to make this small band that just moved from Kona trying to make an album, Kona Town, on Volcom Entertainment, a tiny little independent label. Yeah, he's, I mean, the guy just loves drums, period. And he could be the one that will take us to the drum shop when you come out here. He'll be our grand host, I guess you could say. All
right, so he'll take us to the drums. You got to take us for tacos or food because it's your turn. We used to come to Chicago. We used to go grab some pretty awesome food.
Yep. I was living there. Yep. Done and done. We're down in the South Bay at our studio where we're recording this right now. And when you get here, we'll go do tacos. I'll push you into some waves and we'll do it, man. And I don't know, on that note, I just want to thank you for joining us on the 10th episode of Disposable Heroes, man. That was so much fun.
Dude, I appreciate it. I had a blast. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And once again, I guess, let them know when everyone out there where they can check you out online and the band's website and all that good stuff.
Yeah, I'm on Instagram at Chris Coolis. I do Twitter. I don't do Facebook, but you can reach us anywhere. You know, the band is at Of A Revolution or liveoar.com. Yeah, hit me up. I'd love to hear from you.
Right on, you guys. And then I'm just want to also an extra special thank you for breaking in double digits of the episodes with us, man. This is so super awesome.
Dude, congrats, guys. This is awesome.
Right on. Once again, we got Chris Coolis here from OAR, and that was number 10 of Disposable Heroes. Everyone, have a wonderful day in your world. All right.